The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
This is scary what's going on. And if I can't be angry about it, it's too bad.
I've followed politics fairly closely over the last two decades, kind of dropping in and out of the scene as life takes its twists and turns. Sometimes I feel like I can afford to sit idly by while Congress and the White House do their thing. Sometimes it's just too exhausting to keep up with it all or to try to care about anything beyond my own community and my very small sphere of influence.
The revolution will not be televised.
Lately, I've been trying to overcome this exhaustion, but the changes we're seeing in the U.S. right now are pretty overwhelming. I needed motivation, a reminder for why we should all be involved and awake during this pivotal time in our nation's history.
Elon Musk has got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Elon Musk has got to go!
I went down to the Benton County Courthouse in Corvallis, President's Day afternoon. There were about 150 people there when I arrived holding signs and chanting. I wanted to hear it in their own words. Why? Why now? Why still? How is this going to affect change? And what will be different? Maybe I could be inspired again to feel like America is worth saving.
It's hard to answer questions on the side of the street. I don't know if anyone's ever told you that. I am a Corvallis resident. I recently moved here in the last year. My name is Lily. One of the greatest things about America, I think, is that we can, you know, share our opinion over the car horns like this about what we think our nation can be and how we can make it better.
I'm Caroline Choquette. I think that people need to know we're having a not slow-moving but fast-moving coup with our government.
Why are you here today?
I'm here to show that I don't like Trump and his administration. I feel like our democracy is going down the tubes rapidly, and we have to stand together and do something. And this is just a small thing, but maybe it'll get some people's attention. I think we have the attention of the people that care about this, and the other people aren't listening. So maybe, who knows?
That was my mom, Deb. She's the one who actually got me to come out that day.
I'm Catherine Stearns. I'm a founding member of our Revolution Corvallis Allies and a longtime resident of this area. We're in this for the long haul because this is not going to go away overnight, and we all know that, right? So we're starting to build those coalitions now. Here in Corvallis, there are like plenty of human dignity groups. We all have different missions and statements of what we're working on, but at a time like this, we all come together and we make a mighty noise because we all want our freedom back. We want to stop what's going on.
My name's Mary Hill. Really, just talking to each other without getting upset immediately, you know. We agree on so much, but we've been told that we don't. We've been told that we need to be afraid of the other group. I'm not afraid of the other group, I'm just afraid of who they elected.
When you say the other group, I assume you mean you're talking Republicans versus Democrats.
Pretty much.
I knew most of these people felt the same way as me, by and large. But because I've been feeling so cynical lately, I may have begun my line of questioning a little antagonistically.
I guess what's the threshold, you know, because there have been immigration problems for so many years and...
And because tensions were running high, my first interviewee, Tom, was easily roused.
Yeah, I don't know where you're coming from. If you're not seeing how what's happening in this past week as something that's dangerous to our democracy.
What's happened in the past week?
Don't you know? I have to tell you what it was? This is scary what's going on. Authoritarianism. You know what that is, right? Getting rid of people who might not obey him, and then you have to sign a loyalty oath in order to work. And then there's the thing with the AP.
At some point during our questioning, Tom realized I wasn't just there to goad him, but that I had serious doubts about whether our government was not only able to do something about this threat of authoritarianism, but are they even willing?
If the Republicans were to wake up, would the Democrats step up and actually do something about it as well? Or
I think so. I hope so. There have been many times in my life where I've thought, we need a third party because our two-party system sometimes just doesn't get anywhere at times. But now we're not going anywhere. But you don't see Democrats going out there and doing what Trump did when he lost. Maybe they should have. I don't know.
Others shared my sentiment when pressed on the issue about the current gridlock and divisiveness of our two-party system. I'd felt for many years now like the battle lines being drawn by politicians were meant to keep the masses infighting, rather than focusing on the powerful and privileged elites, and that this was no accident.
On my cynical days, I feel like the duopoly has done all this by design.
It's by design, yes, yes. It's been shown over and over that we definitely have people behind the scenes who have been working very hard to radicalize specific groups and to separate us and to make us afraid and to keep us from voting, and now this is where we're at, and it's horrible.
Can we chalk this all up to decades of increasing bureaucracy?
If you look at the population increase and the increase in the bureaucracy, the bureaucracy has only increased 3% compared to the nation in the last 20 years. So people say, you know, there's too much of it. It's amazing they're getting by with that little increase.
Carolyn knows folks being affected by the executive orders that Trump signed in his first month as president.
I'm seeing organic farmers that had USDA grants to give to the poor. That's probably out. I have a niece who just started with a university and put in an NIH grant, and that's gone.
But my last question to everybody did manage to inspire a little bit of hope in me that things could be different.
What can we do from here? What can we do?
I feel like that's the question on everyone's minds. It's a really silly answer, but do something. If that looks like talking to a relative that you might not agree with and just trying to bridge that gap, that's one thing. It looks like calling your representatives, letting them know whether you approve or disapprove of what's going on. Fivecalls.org is a really great place to start. It's got a lot of scripts that make it pretty accessible to know who to call, what to say. You can just read from the screen about issues that you personally care about.
My answer is general strike. If we fold our arms and stop cooperating with the systems that are oppressing us, that makes a mighty statement right there. If they stop getting rich off our backs, then that'll change things. It's only when you hit their pocketbook that they understand that we mean business.
Do you feel like that's a realistic request from the working class at this point?
Yes, I do. Because you can see everybody across, from federal employees to state employees to contractors, all across this country, all levels of workers are being shut out, having their paycheck taken away, their funding evaporated overnight by some billionaire who's taking $8 million a day of tax money home with him, and he wants to take more from us. No, I think that's a message working class people understand, that we got to put a stop to that.
What would a general strike look like?
A general strike means taking it to the street. When you look at the labor actions and the people actions in Europe, they would have this whole downtown flooded with people in the street. And that's what we need our people to learn how to do and get comfortable with, because it's going to be a long haul.
Our Vice President Trump, he values crowds, so let's give him some.
Sorry, I got so excited. It's my New Yorker and Italian background.
I don't blame Tom for his tone. It's hard to know how we as a people proceed from here, knowing that oligarchy has been effectively greenlit by the highest office in America. Now that we really are hearing the quiet part out loud, maybe Trump's actions will bring these tough but important conversations to the table, finally starting to heal the divide we've been facing. One can hope, anyway. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Ashley Terry.
Thanks for joining us today for KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program Sundays from 1 to 2, repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. We archive the program at korcfm.com. This is Dan Kroll. I'm in the Southtown studio and recently received word that Open Streets Corvallis, returning Sunday, June 29th, is going to be in Southtown again, from Lily Park to Willamette Park. You can find out more information on this event at openstreetscorvallis.org. This is going to be the 7th annual free street festival known as Open Streets Corvallis. Over a mile of city streets between Lily Park and Willamette Park are going to be closed to vehicles for people to walk, bike, skate, dance, and otherwise celebrate our shared public spaces. Activity hubs at each park and mid-route will include bicycle-powered activities, giant-sized games, street installations, art, dance, local food, and live music. Neighbors play an important role in Open Streets Corvallis. The public is invited to join the organizing team, spread the word to neighbors, and or volunteer on the day of the event. You can help activate the route by doing something in your front yard. Maybe organize a music jam, set up a sprinkler, create a shade space, sell vegetables from your garden. Your imagination is the limit. There will be a neighborhood meeting about this upcoming Open Streets Corvallis event, which is taking place Sunday, June 29th. The neighborhood meeting will be Wednesday, February 26th, starting at 6 p.m. at Coho Eco Village, located at 1975 Southeast Crystal Lake Drive in South Corvallis. At this neighborhood meeting, one could learn more about the event and brainstorm ideas for participation. Snacks will be provided at this neighborhood meeting Wednesday, February 26th, 6 p.m. at Coho Eco Village. There is more information on Open Streets Corvallis at openstreetscorvallis.org. The event is taking place Sunday, June 29th, and will be in Southtown this year, from Lily Park to Willamette Park. The event takes place from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC-FM. I'm Don Boucher, and I'm a naturalist from Corvallis, Oregon. In the Willamette Valley, during late winter and spring, you'll hear this sound after sunset and sometimes during daylight hours. This is the sound of Pacific chorus frogs. The Pacific chorus frog is also known as the Pacific tree frog. These cute tiny frogs have bulging eyes, little feet, and each toe has a round pad at the tip. They are often green or brown and have dark eye stripes, but the color varies, and I'll tell you more about that later. Late winter and through the spring is their breeding season, hence the loud choruses. They mate and lay eggs in lakes, ponds, slow-moving streams, shallow bodies of water, flooded fields, ditches, and more. The length and time of the year of their breeding season varies depending on elevation and latitude. Only males can call, and they ribbit to attract females. So when you hear a lot of frogs, remember that the female portion of the population remains silent. Males make another non-breeding call, which is a simple croak. In the Willamette Valley, we have two common frog species, the Pacific chorus frog and the non-native American bullfrog. Bullfrogs make a bellowing call. The native red-legged frog is uncommon and calls primarily while submerged. This is seldom heard because it's very quiet. Pacific chorus frogs are native to western North America, from British Columbia to Baja California, and as far east as Nevada and parts of Idaho. Their ribbit call is familiar the world over because these frogs are common in Hollywood, California. This is where sound engineers in the entertainment industry have captured the sound of the local frog and put it in just about every movie and TV show whenever and wherever frogs are depicted. Apparently, it never mattered to TV and movie producers that no other common frog in the world makes a ribbit sound like our Pacific chorus frog. Pacific chorus frogs are up to 2 inches long. Color and pattern varies between individuals and regionally, but shades of green and brown are common, and many have dark spots. They all have a solid stripe through each eye that extends from the nostril to the shoulder. Some overall variants are gray, cream-colored, or almost black, and some have no spotted pattern. They have a limited ability to change their skin color. It has been observed that at least some individuals can change the tone or hue of their base color, but their eye stripes remain unchanged. Exactly why they do it and how this process works is still being studied. They are often called tree frogs, but they spend most of their time near the ground. With the help of their little toe pads, they can climb vegetation to pursue prey. Adults eat a variety of invertebrates, including flying insects, which they catch with their sticky tongues. Tadpoles eat things like algae, bacteria, and protozoa. To escape harsh conditions, they can climb into rock crevices, animal burrows, buildings, flower pots, or other hiding spots. If they want to leave the place where they hatch, they can cross the land, primarily at night. During the coldest weather, they will seek cover in moist, low-lying areas. They can remain temporarily inactive and can even hibernate for longer periods. They have a limited ability to resist freezing damage by raising the glucose levels in their bodies. During the dry heat of summer, they will similarly remain inactive until rains return. They lay gelatinous egg masses containing a dozen eggs or more, often attached to submerged vegetation, and they hatch into tiny tadpoles. The frogs have a short breeding cycle, and it's possible for there to be two or more broods in a year, depending on environmental conditions or food availability. They breed in lakes, ponds, and slow-moving streams, but thrive in temporary wetlands or pools that dry up in summer where bullfrogs and fish, some of their main predators, cannot live. However, garter snakes, herons, raccoons, and other land predators will take some. This is why they often hide during the day. While calling, they will immediately stop if they detect movement nearby. Any given patch of frogs will spontaneously cycle between silence and calling. To find out more about nature in the Willamette Valley, visit neighborhood-naturalist.com and you'll find links to our YouTube channel, Google Group email list, and you can sign up to get notices about our local field trips.
The following is an article from the Corvallis Gazette Times entitled Eating Disorder Treatment Center Opens in Corvallis, written by Ella Hutcherson. An eating disorder treatment and recovery center has opened its doors in downtown Corvallis. It's the only clinic of its kind in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Right now, its adolescent program is up and running, and its team intends to launch an adult program, along with other services to help people heal their relationship with food and their bodies. The need is just enormous, Nutrition Director Deborah Bella said. Dubbed Prelude, an eating disorder treatment and recovery center, the center was founded by Clinical Director Melissa Grossman Naples, who has spent 35 years as a therapist working with eating disorders. She's practiced in Corvallis since 2011 and told Mid-Valley Media that she often had waiting lists a mile long because there were no other eating disorder-specific services available between Eugene and Portland. Parents would call her in tears asking for help, she said, and she'd really only have online resources to refer them to. Quote, I started thinking, gosh, we really need a treatment center program here, she said while sitting in a plush chair in the tranquil treatment center, the sound of running water softening the silence before clients arrive. It's a masking sound, used during therapy sessions to keep conversation private, she said. Grossman Naples met Bella in 2016 and would refer clients to her as a dietitian. They both have lived experience with eating disorders themselves, got along well, and decided to team up on the Prelude venture a couple years ago. They are joined by Ari Grossman Naples as Director of Business, Operations, and Marketing. It took a long time to find the perfect place to rent, Melissa said, because she and Bella want to be able to take people to restaurants and out shopping as part of the exposure phase in recovery. Prelude is located downtown in the Cree Building on Southwest 3rd Street. The adolescent program is outpatient, so kids can come in after school and go home in the evenings. They meet 4 days a week for group sessions and meals, but they also have individual sessions, family sessions, and nutrition sessions once a week. The reaction from families so far has been positive. Parents tell Melissa, "We're so happy you did this," she said, "because I thought my kid might die." According to the National Eating Disorders Collaboration, eating disorders are serious and potentially life-threatening mental illnesses characterized by disturbances in behavior, thoughts, or feelings toward food, eating and/or body weight, and shape. In the U.S., according to the National Eating Disorders Association, 28.8 million people will suffer from an eating disorder at some point in their lives. The Prelude Outpatient Adolescent Program provides a different level of care than one-on-one therapeutic treatment might, Melissa said. There are goals in mind as kids move through the phases of the program. As they go, they'll start to get more freedom and choice around food, and potentially experience outings or time in the kitchen. But how long that progression takes is individualized. Eating disorders don't get better quickly, Melissa Grossman Naples said. Some places advertise 30-day programs, she said, but clients likely will have to return over and over again. People can absolutely have a wonderful recovery for the rest of their lives and have a great life, she said. They just have to put the work in. That's partly because unhealthy messaging about body types and diets is frequently normalized in modern society and plastered all over social media. According to the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School, eating disorders at least doubled in prevalence during the COVID-19 pandemic. A, quote, perfect storm that likely included increasing exposure to media, Melissa posited. Prelude aims to bring its patients, who are dealing with a wide range of eating disorders, back to health, encourage body positivity, and enforce media literacy to help them navigate the real world. The more contemporary approach to treatment, Bella said, is not to address why did this happen, but rather, here we are, and how can we get you better? For its adolescents, Prelude does something called family-based treatment, or FBT, an evidence-based approach that invites parents into the process. If a teen has an eating disorder, Bella said, they aren't able to deal with food independently. Therefore, at Prelude, parents are part of the treatment team and learn how best to help their kid. Particularly in the beginning, Bella said, restoring nutrition is paramount. In the initial phase of treatment, kids are not in the kitchen. Parents cook, plate, and present the food. In the next phase, kids get a little more autonomy back, perhaps choosing or plating their own snack. Prelude has a chef, who was previously a companion for a friend with an eating disorder, Bella said, and they make meals for the program 4 nights a week. The program also brings in food from restaurants on occasion, and ultimately, the adolescents will be able to go out to eat as part of the treatment process. Beyond nutrition and behavior, there's also a social element to treatment. These adolescents live in a diet culture, Melissa Grossman Naples said. Therefore, it's important to teach parents concepts like all food being good. There's no such thing as bad food, she said. An overarching goal is to keep these adolescents out of residential treatment or hospitalization. That way, they can stay at home, go to school, and be with their families, and their families can stay at their jobs. It's been great for parents to also get the support they need through the outpatient program, Bella said, and to realize they are not alone. Prelude is going to have an adult program and already has amassed a good-sized waiting list, Melissa said. She also hopes to have a separate track for those with binge eating disorder, which is the most common eating disorder in the U.S., according to the National Institutes of Health. The team has approached local high schools about some educational programming for parents. They also want to provide training for healthcare providers and are already familiar with several in the community. Doctors are talking to us, Melissa said, and they're listening. She, Bella, and Ari Grossman Naples are all hoping that Prelude becomes a center for body-positive work in Corvallis and a resource for its residents. They want the treatment center to serve every part of the community. In that vein, Prelude takes any kind of insurance and works with people who eat halal or kosher. Often with eating disorders, people think it's small, age, race, socioeconomic class, but it's not really true, Melissa said. It's everybody. That was an article from the Corvallis Gazette Times titled, Eating Disorder Treatment Center Opens in Corvallis, written by Ella Hutcherson. You're listening to KORC.
Thanks for joining us for KORC News, Music, and Civics. Heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., and archived at our website, korcfm.com. Going to take a quick break from the news and listen to a local artist. Here's Paul Lemoyne, the track called Those Eyes. Listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2, repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. This is Dan Krall, and I am joined by Jenny in the main gallery of the Art Center at the edge of Central Park. How's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
Doing pretty good. We are standing in the main gallery space. During their Howland Open, which, how long is this going on?
The Howland Community Open has been going on for more years than we know, actually. Our former director didn't know how long this open show has been happening. So we've been a nonprofit art center here in Corvallis for over 60 years. I'm fairly certain a version of this show has been happening since that time. But the Jim and Ruth Howland gave a donation that started a fund that helps support this show and keeps it free. And when that donation happened, the name of the show changed, and it became the Howland Community Open.
As we look on the walls, there are many different styles of art represented. About how many individuals submitted to this?
We have a very creative community here in the greater Corvallis area. We had about 260 submissions this year, and they come in over the course of 2 or 3 days. And we had 15 volunteers hang the work as it came in. So that's over 80 hours of volunteer work, so it's a true community effort to put up this show.
Why don't we take a little bit of a walk, and those of you listening on 105.9 FM or streaming us, if you have a chance to come and see this variety of artwork, it is also for sale. You can see the titles, everything from watercolor, photography. I believe I saw some mixed media.
Yeah, large scale, small scale sculpture, woodworking. We've got it all, that's for sure.
And right here, as we're walking around, around the main stage of the main gallery, and there's a work of art called Shawi's Dream of Spirit River by Marta Maxwell, a needle felting work.
Yes, Marta was our People's Choice winner last year. She made a giant eagle for us, and this year she brought in this beautiful raccoon that's communing with nature, holding a fish and a hummingbird is nesting on his head.
A life-size specimen.
Yes.
We also have some stained glass. It's called Abstract 1.1 by Mark Nelson, next to a couple of crows. Two Crows Finding Treasure is the name of this work.
Yeah, this is actually pretty unique. Joan Lintz is the artist who brought this in. And she utilized a 3D printer to create this. So she's been experimenting with new technologies and seeing how it can influence her art practice.
I was going to say that felty kind of sleek appearance on the crows does look like 3D printing. I didn't want to assume. We also have a number of paintings on the wall, a number of styles represented here at the Howland Community Open. How long can the public view this?
This show is open, I think, until March 5th, so a few more weeks. And we will close the gallery for about a week and a half to prepare for our next exhibition.
Yeah, quite an exciting bit of talent on display. What would you say is the most typical kind of artist that you see coming through here as far as the medium they work in?
Oh, we try to keep that as diverse as possible. Whenever the main gallery switches, we hope that it looks completely different than the last show. So, yeah, I wouldn't say we have a standard style here. We really like to stay timely, and we show contemporary living artists who are making work about living life now. So that's our goal.
And where we're standing, it's an old chapel building at the edge of Central Park.
Yes, yeah, we are a converted church, and it was moved here, I believe, from First Street some 60 years ago, and it has been a free art space since then.
What are some of the offerings to the artist community? I know that you do have the artist meetup mm-hmm. the first Thursday of the month.
Yeah, that is a free group for people who want to come and talk to other artists about what they're working on, maybe get some feedback. Very low-key critique group, I would say. It's free to the public once a month. We also offer an artist residency program that we take applications for each year. Artists are given workspace in our basement and given access to classes that can help them develop their entrepreneurial abilities as an artist. And we also have Second Saturdays, which is a family-focused craft event, also free to the public. That's every second Saturday here at the Art Center. Those projects change. I think we're doing journal making next month, and then the following months for National Poetry Month, some blackout poetry activities.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what is blackout poetry?
The National Poetry Month is a celebration of poetry across the nation, and we try to do something that's related to that each year. So for our second Saturday activity, I believe the library is donating books that have been pulled out of their collection, and people will go in and create poems from the words that are on a page by removing words that don't add to their creative expression.
So. I had never heard of that before. Why don't we make our way? We're going towards the north end of the gallery where they have a shop with everything from cards to prints, magnets, and there is an artist's display as you walk in here.
Yeah, as you enter the art center, you'll enter our shop, which is filled with wares from local artists. But to the left is our Corrine Woodman Gallery. It's a smaller project space that we switch out about once a month. Currently, we have our OSU scholarship recipient on display, Emily Cha. She was awarded a residency here at the Art Center over the course of a couple months in order to support her after she graduated to continue making work as an independent artist. And the work that she created during that time is currently on display.
She has a display that, well, basically is this porcelain?
I believe it's just
ceramic of some sort.
Yeah, it's clay. She created persimmons. This is an important symbol of her family heritage. And then on the other wall, you'll see paintings of persimmons and then a painting of her father harvesting them as well.
And the arrangement of the persimmons on this display, it's a very neat, minimalistic, almost like just small little ornaments placed in a random fashion.
She's been exploring her cultural heritage, and these small charms are an important part of the embellishments of the fabrics and patterns that she's been researching. So you'll see that one of the charms is hanging on a bag that she designed, and the rest have been placed as a sculpture on the pedestal.
So if folks wanted to come and check out the gallery, just walk around and see the Howland community open or browse the gift shop, what are the hours?
We're open Tuesday through Saturday, 12 to 5, and we're free and open to the public during that time.
What is coming up in the month of March as far as your offerings for artists?
The main gallery and Corrine Woodman galleries will change. We will have a zine library. The exhibition will be called Potential Spam. That'll be in the Corrine Woodman. People can come, sit, and read through zines that were submitted nationwide.
That's Z-I-N-E, short for magazine.
Short for magazine. Yeah, for those who don't know, a zine is usually a cheaply produced publication. It's a form of art in which artists can self-publish, and a lot of times it's used for propaganda or political influence, but it could also be silly, funny, you know, really fun art. A wide range of zines came in through our call. So yeah, I encourage people to come and dive in and see how artists are expressing through this medium.
Is that call still open, or have the submissions all been received for the zines?
The call is closed, but we will have about 50 or 60 zines set up for people to look through. And it was a pretty successful first year of this type of exhibition, so we're hoping to do it annually. Yeah.
Very cool. Now, if listeners wanted to know more about the Art Center, I know you all have a web presence.
We do. Theartcenter.net is our website. And all of our exhibitions, upcoming exhibitions are posted there, as well as information about Artist Meetup, the Artist Residency, Second Saturdays, etc.
And the address here is 700 Southwest Madison?
It is. We are the church that isn't a church between two churches.
Located at the edge of Central Park, a white chapel with a big red door. It is the Arts Center. And I'd like to thank you again for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for joining us in the gallery.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
The following is a story on the endangered Oregon chub by Fresh Waters Illustrated, a nonprofit right here in Corvallis that's working to raise public awareness about the life, study, and conservation of freshwater ecosystems through immersive visual media and storytelling. This video is produced in partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Departments, with special thanks to the Mackenzie River Trust, Queen Bee Apiaries, Dragonfly Ranch, and Bird Haven Farms. You can find more stories and info, including how to donate, at freshwatersillustrated.org.
You know, you can drive down a road, you can even float down a river, and you really miss these kind of habitats. Oftentimes they have, little riparian forests around them that kind of protect them from view, and they're kind of forgotten. No one kayaks down a swamp. So I think it's easy to look at one of these habitats and think, oh, it's a swamp, it's a slough, it's a bog, just some mud hole. Well, this is actually, we're in part of the river right now, and this is part of the river network. When this floods up, you would think this is part of the river. As you start getting out there and you realize that these things have such diversity to them that they support a lot of life, support a lot of diversity of life. So in sloughs and swamps, Oregon chub were one of the most abundant species in the habitats. An Oregon chub is a small floodplain minnow. They're about 2 inches long. It's the only fish that's endemic to the Willamette River Basin. Endemic meaning it's the only place that it's found.
A trap like that. Now that's mostly Oregon chub though.
A couple hundred years ago, the Willamette Valley was very different than what we see today. The river would have meandered across the floodplain. It wouldn't have had one channel, but many channels. And as it moved naturally across the floodplain, it left behind lots of remnants. Sloughs, swamps, oxbow lakes. These are the kind of places where Oregon chub would have done really well. Jump forward to today. The valley, instead of having many channels, we now have one single channel in most places. A lot of the swamps, the sloughs, the oxbow lakes have been filled in, either for agriculture, or they've been cut off from the floodplain by roads and development. On top of that, a number of dams were built to contain high flows. Those flows, those high flow events that at one point flooded the whole valley bottom, were the kind of flows we needed to actually let the river meander and change course through the Willamette Valley. And those were the flows that were required to actually create new habitats. So the Willamette River went from being a very wild river with high floods to being tamed. And during that time period, no one really thinking about what's happening to some of these species that were obligate to these habitats, that only lived in these habitats. When researchers went out to check on Oregon chub populations, especially in the main stem river where they were dominant, all those populations were gone. Those Oregon chub populations were replaced by non-native fish species. And they started raising the alarm, saying there might be a problem here. Oregon chub were listed as endangered in 1993.
Good condition, its body's thick.
The focus on the early steps of our recovery were protecting the populations we had left. And we also started an introduction program for Oregon chub, basically backing up these populations. Anybody who's driven through the Willamette Valley knows this is an agricultural landscape. To do conservation of Oregon chub meant going into privately owned land.
Beautiful baby hive that's just about needing more space.
I'm Karen Finley.
And I'm Tad Buford. And we are the owner-operators of Queen Bee Honey Company.
Besides the bees that we have here on the farm, we run hives for both pollination and honey production all around.
As biologists by training, we see that one of the big problems with beekeeping is the simplification of the landscape. Because Oregon chub was coming into everybody's attention, they were looking for places to restore it, and this little draw right here was ideal because there were no non-native predatory species here.
Lots of fish.
They did an excellent job installing the pond.
They took care of all the details behind the scenes, and when we had control about what they did and where they did it, but we never really had a lot of effort that we had to put into it.
It was quickly finished, and then one season it started growing in, and it's just been growing ever since then.
It's beautiful, and it brings in a lot of birds as well, so it adds a lot of life to the place.
There are ducks on this pond all winter.
Uh-huh.
And there'll be wood ducks, little hatch out babies we'll see down there every year.
They're beautiful little fish. I love knowing that they're in there. And I like knowing the story behind them. They're kind of connecting us with the creek, and I'm happy to know they're there.
It's been really important that we have had Oregon chub populations established remotely in some very safe areas, and numbers and genetic diversity built up and strengthened. At the same time, it's been critically important that we've been able to secure and enhance and restore some of these areas that used to be a part of the Willamette's living river system. So when the Trust first acquired Green Island, it was pretty daunting to look at the restoration of nearly 1,000 acres of habitat. And the majority of the acreage was still active farmland. That transition over the last now 13 years, from trees planted in the ground to native forests growing, from a dike that had held the river at bay being removed to watching the water come back into some of those sloughs that had been waiting and just hadn't seen water for a long time. So we're getting to the point where some of those earliest trees are now 30 and 40 feet tall.
Mosquito fish. Yeah. Little bluegill.
Yeah. But if I came out here and expected to see an Oregon chub every time we ran a seine through a side channel, I'd be sorely disappointed. But we know that we're creating space for them. As more fish get into the system and disperse within the system, they act as sources for each other that fish can move back and forth. In a place like this, we'll see a handful of chub every year. And we think that, yeah, they're probably getting moved out while other ones get moved in year to year. And when they come through, it's gonna be good because they're gonna find places to be.
Looking good.
We are here today to announce the official final delisting of the Oregon chub. The Oregon chub is the first fish ever to be delisted from the Endangered Species Act.
After two decades of recovering Oregon chub, it was pretty exciting when we started kind of crunching the numbers and we were going through the data, realizing that we had met our recovery goals for Oregon chub. I think the Oregon chub recovery story is a great story to share and to celebrate. And we have a lot of momentum that's behind this Oregon chub kind of movement that we want to make sure is maintained. But just because Oregon chub aren't endangered anymore doesn't mean we aren't still helping them. The Endangered Species Act is oftentimes referred to like the emergency room in a hospital. But it doesn't mean that once you're able to leave the emergency room that you don't still need to have regular care. So Oregon chub aren't at the critical state that they once were. But there's still frontiers for us in the recovery of the species. There's still things that we're working towards to see that Oregon chub will persist well into the future.
See how these little guys are doing. Okay. So I'm gonna take care, guys.
For us, it means another species that can survive. We can help the Oregon chub survive. It goes with our whole idea of preserving the little bit of land we have to be Willamette Valley. And these fish are part of it.
Just trying to get those little elements all put together to have a bigger effect.
And now we have chub.
Now we have chub. little bit at a time.
Hey, everybody ready?
In my short time working on the species, I've seen a major change in the way people look at their role in maintaining this ecosystem and this environment. It's not just Oregon chub. There's a lot of species that can use our help, and that a lot of us can do things to help these species out.
Here they come.
We've put a lot of building blocks in place, and we've put a lot of processes in place in these kind of upstream tributary habitats. We're starting to see some Oregon chub slowly kind of trickling down to the lower ends of these habitats. And I guess my long-term dream for the species is that when we find one out in a main stem habitat in the tributaries, that it's not a surprise.
That was a story on the endangered Oregon chub by Freshwaters Illustrated, a nonprofit right here in Corvallis that's working to raise public awareness about the life, study, and conservation of freshwater ecosystems through immersive visual media and storytelling. This video is produced in partnership with the U.S. Department and the Oregon Departments of Fish and Wildlife, with special thanks to the Mackenzie River Trust, Queen Bee Apiaries, the Dragonfly Ranch, and Birdhaven Farms. You can find more stories and info, including how to donate, at freshwatersillustrated.org. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics at 105.9 FM or streaming globally at korcfm.com.
On Monday, February 17th, President's Day, hundreds of people gathered with signs of protest, chanting, and showing their dismay at the government coup taking place in our nation. At the Benton County Courthouse on Monday, it was a mix of ages, some with American flags, right side up or upside down.
What does democracy look like? This is what democracy looks like.
There were signs ranging with messages like, resist, protect immigrants, you didn't vote for this. One said, hired for the people, fired by the billionaire. Another said, stop Musk, the puppet master.
What does your sign say?
Respect our allies. And no taking over other countries.
Among the allies that Trump has alienated in just the last 2 weeks, which one would you say is the most consequential?
Oh my goodness. Well, alienating all of the NATO countries is very consequential. Deep-sixing Canada and Mexico makes no sense. Taking over Greenland and Panama, no. You know, he's just destabilizing the entire world, all of the allies. They know they can't trust us anymore. I think the 2025 plan is all about this, and he's just falling in line with the people who are funding it.
This is what democracy looks like.
Have you ever seen anything like this in America before?
Yes. America has a whole history of institutionalizing racism and xenophobia. And Trump is just playing that same card. It's been going on for over 100 years.
Various chants arose in parts of the crowd, standing along the curbs on both sides of 4th Street in front of the county courthouse.
Elon Musk has got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Elon Musk has got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Elon Musk has got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Elon Musk has got to go!
A similar theme I found when talking with people was the concern of democracy itself slipping away.
I'm a German historian by training and taught modern German history for 25 years, and there are some very striking parallels, as a lot of people have already pointed out, between contesting the rule of law and asserting rights that don't exist constitutionally and simply lying to all of us.
Is it hyperbole when people say, that use the word Nazi in conjunction with Elon Musk or Donald Trump?
I don't think it's hyperbole. I think you always have to be careful But I think the desires for power and the way that they're crafting power and assuming power are very, very similar.
One thing I noticed in this protest, as opposed to a number of protests in this space outside the Benton County Courthouse over the years, was the amount of support from passersby. Oftentimes, the reaction is mixed, sometimes apathetic and indifferent, and not without occasional middle fingers or thumbs down from people driving by. However, the support on this President's Day was overwhelmingly in favor. Honks and waves of support came from unlikely parties, including a few logging trucks. In this one, the driver gave an enthusiastic honk and an energetic thumbs up as he slowed at the approaching red light. The crowd grew as the noon hour descended, and I had a chance to cross the street and face the courthouse to get a better look at the crowd lining the sidewalk. There were about 300 to 400 people by this point.
We are outside of the Benton County Courthouse on this Monday as I record, and there is a gentleman across the street standing between some cars and is holding up a life-size sign. What does this say?
It says, Trump and Musk robber barons.
And what does it depict?
It depicts classic look of a robber baron from the late 1800s, but with the face replaced by a two-headed monster. That is Trump and Musk.
For those listening who may be out of the loop as to what is happening on the national scene, can you sum it up?
With a narrow majority in the election in 2024, President Trump has decided to create a coup d'etat for this nation, and we're not going to let it happen. And so it's one reason we're here right now. We're going to write letters to the editor. We're going to shame our Republican representatives for not standing up to this coup leader. This is what democracy is all about.
Is there any element that gives you the most hope that we would get through this as Americans?
I would say the resolve of people now realizing the mistakes they've made in voting for this ban is going to come around. There will be economic reasons to force his hand on this. Decisions he's made without thought that are going to hurt him and the nation economically. Often it is economics that turns the public policy the right way. In this case, we're going to lose workers, we're going to lose trade, we're going to lose health. All of those things are going to come back, bite him, and they're going to bite us in the meantime, too. So we have to be prepared for that.
Have you ever seen anything like this in America?
No. I read about the Civil War and realized that this is more of a threat than that was. Because it's likely, it's headed towards taking over us as a monarchy, and we were not quite as to a monarchy in 1864, but now we're headed that way. So we've got to stand up, shout, and shame people into realizing the mistakes they've made, but also understanding that they are people just like we are, and they had reasons to vote for Trump. Now I think they'll see that some of those reasons were mistaken.
Other voices from the crowd at the protest this past Monday, President's Day, shared a ring of concern.
Sir, why are you here today?
I'm here to support the country, and I will not tolerate the loss of our democracy because of oligarchs. Down with the douchebags. Complete law breaking and no Congress backing our rights up. It's like illegal activity.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, muskrat has gotta go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, muskrat has gotta go. Woo! Power to the people and the planet and all our relatives.
Just gathering like this, ensuring that we're taking care of each other, because, I mean, government programs and systems, I don't know where they're going to go. I don't know how that's going to happen. We're already seeing the effects. So I don't want that to trickle down any further. And if we don't start taking care of each other directly, then we might not have a choice. So I think we got to really start just communicating and gathering as community members and trying to understand each other and, you know, do these protests where we can have real conversations with each other and try to understand each other's point of view.
By the time I left, the crowd was starting to dwindle as folks returned to work following this lunch break. Others went home or dispersed into downtown. A number of college-age kids remained and held signs and waved at oncoming traffic. Corvallis and communities around the world look at these unprecedented times with vigilance and a number of us with deep concern. Time will tell, but if they successfully dismantle American democracy, one could argue that it was done too easily and quickly. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker recently remarked in a speech, "It took the Nazis 1 month, 3 weeks, 2 days, 8 hours, and 40 minutes to dismantle a constitutional republic." Pritzker then remarked, "I have just one question. What comes next?" For KORC, News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll. Thank you.